all great performers were once children. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. NPR's From the Top is a program that showcases the performances of young musicians. A new round of auditions for young Iowan musicians is coming up, and today we'll talk with a young man who has already been through that audition process. He'll be featured on an upcoming program performing classical music on his saxophone. We'll find out why he performs, and we'll also talk with his teacher about her work training the next generation of musicians. Later on the program, we'll be joined by Guy Raz, the host of Weekend All Things Considered on NPR. We'll talk with him about the fifth edition of the 3-Minute Fiction Contest, which will be judged, in part, by members of the Iowa Writers Workshop. Please join our conversation, 866-780-9100. Call us after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. NPR's From the Top is a program that showcases the performances of young musicians. You can hear the show on Saturday and Sunday afternoons on the classical stream from Iowa Public Radio. A new round of auditions for young Iowan musicians is coming up, and today we're going to talk about young musicians performing at a very high level, and who better to start with than one of those young musicians. Justin Mosier is a senior at Iowa City West High School. He went through an earlier audition process and has been selected to perform on From the Top. The performance we'll hear on the radio will be taped live on October 12th in Davenport, Iowa at the Adler Theater, and you can still get tickets to be in that audience. Justin is an accomplished musician, and he will be performing on the alto saxophone. Justin, when did you first start playing music?
Music was in kindergarten. I started playing piano with my mom. She taught me, and my grandma. Yeah, I was 5 years old, if that was the age. And then I started playing, if you want to answer the saxophone, I started playing saxophone. I was fourth grade, about halfway through that.
When you first started playing saxophone, was that with school band or something that you picked up outside of school?
In fourth grade, there is no band for that. So I started a little bit earlier because I knew I wanted to play saxophone. So I got a little head start on that. And then I had a few months to get ready before fifth grade band started, because that's when schools provide band.
It sounds to me, since you wanted to get a head start, like, you were taking it pretty seriously from the very beginning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I knew I wanted to play saxophone. I practiced, and yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Why the saxophone?
Because my dad, ever since I was born, on Sunday mornings, he would always play jazz music. And, of course, the saxophone's always had awesome solos, and I wanted to improvise and get that sound. And I love this saxophone sound. I love that sound.
And you do think about saxophones as being something that you hear a lot in jazz and rock music as well. I don't think of it usually as a classical music instrument.
It's not really, yeah.
But you are playing classical music.
Yeah, and that's what I try to do. I try to convey this very dark and rich tone that not many people think the saxophone can do. I mean, if I can show that, then that'd be great. That'd be great.
When did you first start getting interested in playing classical music on the saxophone?
Ever since I started playing saxophone, or having saxophone lessons with my teacher, Jane Williams, immediately that's what she did. We started on easier classical pieces, and then I got into the harder repertoire, and I did a little bit of jazz with her, but it was always classical, and then that's what I came to love from that.
All right, and do you play jazz too?
Oh yeah, I play jazz in junior high, and I play jazz band in high school right now.
How much time do you spend practicing outside of school?
In the beginning years, it was a lot, and then it kind of dwindled down in junior high and the beginning of high school. And, well, especially for the last couple of months, I have been putting a lot of effort in. Almost every day I've been practicing. It's not as much as I know I should be, and I know if I did it a lot more, I could do a lot more. But it kind of depends on just how busy I am that year with school and what I'm doing.
Right. Well, the life of a high school student is a very busy one. Plus, you work outside of school.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
And I looked at your resume. You've been involved in a lot of other extracurricular activities.
Yes.
As well. Why is music so important to you?
Oh, it just always has been. I've grown up with it. My mom and my grandma were really into music. My sister does it. My dad doesn't. He was in music, but then he stopped. But I don't know. I've just always loved performing and playing. I don't know.
What does it feel like when you perform classical music on your saxophone for an audience? What's going on inside of you?
I'm so concentrated and so focused on what's in front of me, just just trying to make that saxophone sound as best as possible. And like, if it's a slow piece, I want to make the audience cry. If it's a fast piece, this amazing feeling that I can't get anywhere else other than by performing music for other people. That's what I get.
How did you decide what you'd be performing? Is this the piece that you performed at the audition?
This is a different piece. Okay. I'm playing Lamento de Rondo by San Can. It's a faster piece, more notes. And because of that, I try to, at the same time, get that just because it's fast notes doesn't mean that you can sing and be very expressive on all the notes together in a long run.
Okay.
My teacher and I decided to play this piece after the audition. We were deciding between two different pieces, and this one just kind of came out better. And when I was practicing, the other one just – we didn't seem it would come across to the audience as best as this one would, and the best of my abilities. And the way that I could perform it was better than the other one.
How difficult is it to find classical music arranged for saxophone?
It's a little difficult because the saxophone, there's not much music written for it as like a cello or a clarinet. They've been a lot in the world for a lot longer. And so class music is much more limited. There's a definite select repertoire that are standard. And then there's a lot of contemporary stuff that's being written that's, in my opinion, a little strange. But yeah, we do have to – there's some pieces to get like Bach. We have arrangements that were originally played on a violin, but then they're transcribed to play like as a saxophone piece.
You have had many honors as a musician. You've been at Allstate 3 years in a row. What does it mean to you to be chosen to perform on this program?
It's a great honor for sure. I've heard about it from the top, and I just like hearing the people play on that show. They're absolutely amazing, and I listened to one of the shows a while back, and I got very intimidated, and I was like, oh my gosh, I don't even know if I want to play on the show, but it'll be quite an experience, and it means a lot to me.
What are your future plans after graduating in May?
I'm hoping to go to a school with a good engineering program, and depending on the way things work, majoring in engineering and then also either doing a double major or minor in saxophone performance.
Of course, music is not considered to be the most practical field to go into, but clearly this is something that you have a lot of passion for and a lot of talent for. Why not make it the focus of your education?
I love music, and I also love science at the same time. And so it would be a dream of mine to see that I can take music to throughout my entire life.
When you look ahead after college, and I know that many things will change in the next 5 or 6 years, but what is your dream? How do you hope to incorporate music into your life?
Well, I've always been by day wanting to be an engineer, and then by night being a musician. Having a job in engineering or in science stuff is one thing, but then you're not going to get that same feeling that you do when you perform for people in music. And just I don't want to lose that. I want to keep that feeling and that. Just that throughout my entire life, and I don't want to miss that. That's
Justin,
why I keep doing that.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Justin Mosier will be performing in Davenport at the Adler Theater on October 12th. His performance will air on From the Top at a later date on Iowa Public Radio's classical stream. And with us now is his saxophone coach, Jane Williams, who has been teaching both classical and jazz saxophone in Iowa City for more than a decade. Jane, tell me a little bit about the students who come to you.
Well, I usually get them by word of mouth, but I haven't really spent a lot of time trying to find them. But they're kind of coming from all ages. Sometimes I get the little ones. I don't get as many beginners now, but I get a lot of them starting in sixth and seventh grade, and sometimes I'll get them halfway through high school. But they're all kind of different ages, and they want to start for different reasons. And then I just kind of figure out how the student works, and then we go from there.
Why do students come to you usually? I mean, when you take band at school, there are band lessons at school and band rehearsals at school, and saxophone is one of those instruments that kids usually pick up in the fifth grade, not like Justin picking it up a little bit earlier.
Right.
But why would they seek lessons outside of school?
A saxophone lesson or any private music lesson is so important to a young musician because a lot of their band directors, they're so good. I really respect band directors, but they don't have a lot of time to spend with each student individually. And when they have a private lesson, it gives the teacher time to address the intricacies of the instrument and help them understand the details and the way to play musically. With a band director, they're so busy that they usually are trying to get them to learn the music for their performances. Some of them have the time to address specific issues, but they might not play that instrument themselves, so they can help them with certain issues. But from what I understand, there was a survey done a few years ago at Allstate. They usually find that about 98% of students who make Allstate take private lessons, because you just need that one-on-one attention to learn the instrument better.
When students come to you, does it tend to be because they've shown talent and their parents are looking for a little extra interaction? Or I guess I'm wondering if this urge to seek out private lessons and spend more time with the instrument is coming usually from the students or from their parents?
I think it's a combination of both, because if I get a really little kid, like a sixth grader, it's the parents. But sometimes the high school kids suddenly realize that they want to get better at the instrument. But when they choose to take private lessons, I think now it's a combination of things, because I have been able to have the time to develop a little bit of a reputation as a saxophone instructor. So sometimes they come because they know what my reputation is. And then sometimes they come just because they want to be first chair. It depends on the age of the kid, and sometimes they have natural ability. I get students who start out just like anyone else, but if they practice, I think a lot of it comes from patience as well. I'll start any student at any level and figure out where they are, and then we just try to get that student to the best playing ability that they can. I never encourage them to go into music. I don't care how good they are. It has to come from them. But I want them to be able to enjoy playing music and have fun playing the saxophone. So by teaching them how to play music instead of just a bunch of right notes and rhythms, they get better on their own fairly quickly. But sometimes it takes 6 months and sometimes it takes a few years for that to click on for them. But it's just a matter of patience with the student. But my main focus is just trying to make them enjoy the playing.
My guest is Jane Williams. She's a saxophone coach in Iowa City, teaching both classical and jazz saxophone. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment, talking about teaching the next generation of musicians. Also, if you'd like to join our conversation, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about teaching the next generation of young musicians. Coming up shortly, From the Top, which is a program that you can hear on Iowa Public Radio's classical music stream, is going to be featuring some Iowan musicians. There are some auditions coming up, which made us think about these classically trained young musicians performing at a very high level. And with me right now is Jane Williams, and she teaches many very gifted young musicians. She's a saxophone coach who teaches both classical and jazz saxophone in Iowa City. And Jane, before the break, you talked about teaching children to play music as opposed to just teaching them the right notes. Can you draw that distinction for me?
Well, it is a distinction because a lot of the times when we learn how to practice, we go to band and our teachers say, oh, okay, well, go home and practice. And so we'll grab our saxophone or whatever we're playing and go home and we'll pull it out and we'll play for a little bit and put it back and we'll be like, well, I hope I can play it in my lesson tomorrow. But we're not really necessarily have a good time doing it. There's so many students where you're just like, I was the same way when I was little. I understand this because I was the same way, is that you're just playing. And I enjoyed playing, but I didn't really like practicing. And so my big thing is trying to teach them how to have fun practicing. And the difference in that is learning how much it really takes in thinking. Because a lot of us have a tendency to separate ourselves from a professional or somebody that we really admire as a musician. We'll see them play and we'll say, wow, that person's so great. They're so into their music. But then we never ask ourselves, what do I have to do to be in my music? And when you start asking a student about what their favorite performances have been, and then I'll say, well, did you think they were in their music? And the student will say, oh, yeah. I'm like, what does that mean? And they'll say, I don't know. And so we sit there and spend a lot of time trying to figure out what that means, and then what they need to do to try to put more thought into what they're doing and how to make the music flow a little bit more and how to give it direction. And when they start to understand that they themselves can make it do something, they really enjoy it. And my favorite quote was just recently. I had an eighth grader a few months ago, and he's this giant tenor player. He's just very tall, and he's an eighth grader. And we worked on our music, and I had him try it finally. And he turned to me, and he's got this giant light in his eyes, and he says, wow, that was funner. And I was like, nice. It is funner. Exactly. So that's what we're trying to spend time on, because otherwise they're just bored and they're just playing anything. And I'll play examples. I'll play something really just the way we practice it. And I'll be like, are you bored yet? And they'll say, yes, I'm very bored. And then I'll play it again. And they're like, oh. And then I say, now you have to ask, how do I do that? And then they start to try to think a little bit more, and they start to try it. And then they're not quite so separated from somebody who's already doing it. They need to understand that they can do it too, and they don't have to say, oh, that person's a professional and I play like this. So I try to teach them to do that.
Saxophone is an instrument that kids usually come to in late elementary school when band begins. There are many other instruments, though, that children can start earlier. A lot of string instruments with the Suzuki method, kids are starting at age 4 or 5 or 6. And, of course, piano lessons can begin at any time. How do you feel about when a child should start taking lessons?
Well, I think they should start. They should always start young if they can. I love when they get with, because when they have piano lessons, they already have an idea of how to read. They don't have to learn how to count. They know what the notes are. They just have to learn the fingerings. But the younger they start, they at least learn how to count. I don't know if their particular teacher is teaching them how to think musically, but there are some really wonderful teachers in Iowa City and around. You never know how they're teaching. But then when I get them, we just start there. And if they already know how to read, it makes it much easier for them to pick it up. And we can start playing musically a lot sooner than trying to make it work first. But I think the younger, the better when they're trying to just start in it. But I've had them start in fifth grade on saxophone before, and they become really wonderful players too. So I think it's so individual. So my main focus is that everybody can play musically and they can play well, and they don't necessarily have to spend 18 hours a day practicing to be excellent. They just have to learn how to practice. We don't spend a lot of time teaching how to practice, so I spend a lot of time teaching the how. And then they're learning effective practice, and then they're just learning how to have fun, and they learn the music faster because it's fun.
When did you first start playing an instrument?
I started piano when I was 7, and hated practicing. I just hated it. And then I liked it somewhere around in 8th grade, but in 5th grade I picked up saxophone. But I can tell you that, and I'm not going to confess when I figured this out, but understanding the musical aspect, even though I really enjoyed it, it took me until I was much older to understand.
Oh, come on. When did you figure that out?
Well, I think I played well. But I think when I really learned to understand what somebody I admire was thinking, I was older. But I think that's what makes me a good teacher, because I had to work so hard.
Because you remember that moment of discovery.
I remember the moment of discovery. I call it the musical moment. You know,
what happened? What? Tell me the story.
Well, I don't remember. I was listening. I was thinking, wow, what's Yo-Yo Ma thinking on this amazing prelude? It's so good. I was like, oh, he's thinking about every single note. And then I thought, Well, you know, he's not sitting there thinking about lunch right now. He's thinking about just the music and how it goes. And a lot of us check out when we're practicing. We're thinking about homework or lunch or what we're going to do later. We just want to get done. But Yo-Yo Ma's sitting there playing this amazing cello prelude, and I was loving it. And I realized, I was just like, oh, he doesn't have time to think about lunch right now. And when I explain that to students, they it really clicks with them, too, because we all do it. We all check out a little bit. I would say that I'm the average student who figured some stuff out, and I know how to get it across because it was later, but also because it's always been something that I had to work at. So I've had to fix a lot of things. It's easier to teach when you have to fix it yourself.
David is on the line from Des Moines. Hello, David.
Good morning.
Hi, what would you like to ask?
Oh, well, it's extremely timely. My daughter's in band, has been taking saxophone just through schools for, this is her third year, and last year was introduced to the Barry Sax, and but this year she's extremely bored. And so
yeah, because Barry parts are boring.
Yes, yes. And she was actually told she can go back to, you know, playing the alto if she'd like, but he wants to keep her, you know, keep her with the Barry also, just for the expanded opportunities as she gets older.
Well, it is hard to find a good Barry player.
And she seemed to have a knack for it, so, you know, the band instructor wanted to keep her in it. But we thought maybe private lessons, you know, would be the thing for her right now. And so we've been, you know, just tossing around, trying to get references. And I thought maybe you'd be able to help with just questions I should ask, things to look for in a potential private instructor.
Yeah, well, you definitely should get private lessons if she enjoys playing, because the Barry part can be very boring in band. And so, in fact, a lot of the saxophone parts can. And so when they take private lessons, they have the opportunity to play something that's a lot more challenging than what they'll find in a band situation. So when you're searching for an instructor, you kind of want to ask them what you want to know what their education is. You want to know if they what instrument they started on, if it's because sometimes they play saxophone as a secondary or a tertiary instrument, or sometimes they were a band director and they want it, which is great. But sometimes, again, they don't always know the intricacies. So if you can find somebody who plays it as their first or maybe secondary instrument, and then that they have some experience doing it, you might be able to ask them what their students have done in the past, and what if they're proud of their studio and their accomplishments themselves for the students. I think one of the important things is that the teacher really cares about their studio, because there are some teachers who teach just to get the paycheck. So when you're asking those questions, you want to get an idea that they really care about the students' learning, because that's the best environment for them to get better.
David, thank you so much for your call. And Jane, before I let you go, you mentioned that you don't ever encourage your students to go into music. Let's say they don't. Let's say they perform with you. They perform well. What do you think they can take out of that experience, even if it's not something that they're going to pursue in the future?
Oh, I love it, because I've had so many good students go on to other careers. But I think what they take from it is that they had the opportunity to learn to love music more than because they were able to play it that way. And sometimes they do continue with it. Sometimes I will say, hey, maybe you should consider a minor at least. But they can continue with it. They can come back to it. And if they find that it's something they want, they'll be able to come back to it with the understanding to know what it'll take to get it back or to continue with it. Because sometimes they go on and then they'll still play in college, or they'll play jazz gigs somewhere, and they'll keep it as a side thing. And I think that that's what they really enjoy about it.
All right, Jane, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Jane Williams is a saxophone coach who teaches both classical and jazz saxophone in Iowa City. She's been doing that for more than a decade. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and now we change gears a little bit. We were talking about the NPR program From the Top a moment ago. Now we're going to talk about the NPR program Weekend All Things Considered. Guy Raz is here with us today, and he recently took the helm as the host of Weekend All Things Considered. Hello, Guy.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here.
Of course.
And we wanted to talk a little bit today about the fifth edition of the 3-Minute Fiction Contest. I know the deadline is coming up shortly, but tell me a little bit about the contest.
Well, Charlie, we started the contest in June of 2009, right around the time I became the host of the program. And what we ask listeners is to submit an original piece of fiction that can be read in under 3 minutes on the program. So a story that can't be longer than 600 words. And we've had four rounds. We're now in the midst of round five. And each round, our new judge throws out a challenge that we ask listeners to abide by, and it throws a bit of a twist into the competition, but it makes it very exciting.
And what's the challenge this time around?
Well, this time the challenge is the first line has to begin, "Some people swore that the house was haunted," and the last line has to be, "Nothing was ever the same again after that."
And many things can happen in the 3 minutes that can intervene
yeah.
in between there.
Yeah, it can be a thriller. It can be a ghost story. It can be something unrelated to that. The whole idea is that somebody writing this story has to work within those parameters to come up with something creative.
How did this idea come about?
Well, it came up about a year ago. I was thinking of a way to sort of create something more interactive with our listeners, you know, something that would allow our listeners to sort of contribute something to the show creatively. And we came up with this idea. James Wood, the New Yorker literary critic, was the judge of the first round, and it was great. And since then, we've received about 20,000 original stories.
Well, I actually want to play one of the entries that you had for the fourth round of the contest. And the rules for this round was that you asked people to send in original works of fiction that contain each of these words: plant, button, trick, and fly. And this is Perfect Blue by Wyatt Spear.
Perfect Blue by Wyatt Spear. David had always thought of himself as an artist. He knew he wasn't very good, but that would come with time. All he needed to carry him forward was inspiration. He looked for it every day. That was how he had discovered Perfect Yellow. He was pawing through a yard sale to find subjects for a still life when he found it. It was a button, one of several, sewn to an ancient, dingy hat. It was made of some primitive form of plastic. Age and sun had changed it from its original muted hue to a vibrant yellow. It wasn't merely striking, it was truly perfect. He bought the hat and took it back to his apartment, where he discarded everything but his prize, the physical incarnation of the color. It opened his eyes. If there was one perfect color, there had to be more. He had to find them. He needed no rationale. It was a calling. His friends and family encouraged him. At first, Perfect Yellow had been a fluke. David devised a systematic approach to find the others, canvassing antique malls and pawn shops. That fruitless endeavor kept him busy until inspiration struck. He flew to Brazil. There he was sure he would find Perfect Green. The rainforest proved a great disappointment at first. Yes, there was a lot of green, but chlorophyll could only take a color so far. His mistake was looking for a plant. One morning, he woke to find a tiny jumping spider resting on his sleeping bag, staring at him. The spider was perfect green. He claimed it for his own. He was only a little sad when he discovered it had died on the flight home. Its shell was still the vivid ideal of greenness. Problems began to arise with the search for perfect red. David wasn't really working anymore. His friends and family grew increasingly concerned or distant as his request for support grew more monotonous. He found no inspiration to guide him. He stared at sunsets until his eyes burnt. He skulked in gem shows and community gardens, hoping that some ruby or petal might have captured true red. He considered a study of blood and was only dissuaded by the difficulty of preserving its fresh color. When he finally found perfect red, he was staying in a hostel doing odd jobs in exchange for room and board. The throw rug in one of the back rooms was a muddy brown until he scourged decades of grime out of it and discovered his chromatic quarry. Overjoyed at his good fortune, he stuffed it in his backpack and ran. David became a drifter. He moved slowly from state to state searching for perfect blue. He found a glass eye in a curiosity shop that he thought was it and spent his last dime to learn it was only a trick of a light. he hitchhiked to the seaside and perused tide pools and aquariums, hunting for sea creatures that might have chosen the color for themselves. He cried often, not from regret or hunger, although he often felt both, but at the beauty of the three perfect colors he had found and his longing for the fourth. One clear winter afternoon, with his eyes full of tears, David looked out at the sea. He saw it where the sky blended into the ocean. Then he blinked, and it was gone.
That's Perfect Blue by Wyatt Spear, read by our very own Dennis Reese. And with me right now is Guy Raz, the host of Weekend All Things Considered on NPR. And we're talking about the fifth edition of the 3-Minute Fiction Contest. And Guy, thanks for staying with us through. I thought it would be wonderful to have an example of some of the really clever things that have come out of the contest. And your website is full of them. Have you been surprised by all of the entries that you've gotten?
Oh, it's been amazing. I mean, who could have expected 20,000 stories, right? I mean, all of this creativity all over the country. And there was no way, you know, we knew when we started it out, it was sort of haphazard, and we never sort of expected this kind of avalanche, this flood of creativity. But I think it basically speaks to this untapped wellspring out there, you know, this amazing creativity all over the country. And we've received submissions from every corner of the country.
And we will talk more about that in a moment. I'm talking with Guy Raz. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me is Guy Raz. He's the weekend host of NPR's All Things Considered. And we are talking right now about the 3-Minute Fiction Contest, which is a fairly new innovation on Weekend All Things Considered, and you're in the fifth round of the contest. Let's talk about judging, because I know that this is actually what piqued our interest around here, because members of the Iowa Writers Workshop, which is based in Iowa City, participate in the judging process. But how does it work?
Well, you know, what happened at the beginning was we didn't expect this sort of flood of stories to come in. So in the first round, it was our staff. We have a small staff. It's only about 8 of us that read about 5,000 stories. Now, we had to do that and also produce a weekly news program. And we realized that was untenable. So by the time we reached round 3, we kind of forged a relationship, an informal relationship with the Iowa Writers Workshop. And, of course, that's where these incredibly talented young writers go to then become these very talented, famous older writers. And the sort of the list of graduates from that program is legendary. So these young writers, students at the workshop, go through the first round of submissions. So for this round now, we're in round 5, I think we've received about 2,000 stories so far. And it closes. The deadline is this Sunday at midnight. And they will go through this, you know, these first submissions. They will then pass on several hundred to us, to the staff of Weekend All Things Considered. We'll go through them, and then we will pass along a few hundred to the judge. In this round, it's Michael Cunningham, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And he, of course, he's the author of the book The Hours, which won the Pulitzer Prize about a decade ago. He has a new book coming out, by the way, called By Nightfall. So it's very cool to be working with him and to have that connection with the Iowa Writers' Workshop as well, which doesn't only make the competition better and better judged, but it also makes it so much more collaborative.
I noticed that on your website you incorporate some of the comments made by the people who originally read these stories at the Writers' Workshop. Why do you think that's important for people to see?
You know, I think that it's important to get feedback. I mean, every writer wants it and doesn't want it. Everybody wants it. And we think we want it and then we don't want it. But it's really important. It's vital. And it doesn't necessarily – the feedback that writers will get isn't necessarily the beginning and end. You know, we get a lot of feedback on our program and we get a lot of conflicting feedback about what we do. And I'm sure you do as well, Charity. But the important thing about feedback is to get a sense of how people are reading or hearing or sort of absorbing what you're putting out there. And it can only serve to make it better. I mean, I know it sounds like a bit of a cliche, but it's crucial, especially for a writer. You have to go through that kind of trial, you know. It's not always comfortable to hear to hear somebody say things that might be negative about your work. But we always hope, and I think in general it's been the case, that the feedback has been very constructive. The story that we heard just a few minutes ago was not a winner, by the way. That was one of the finalists. But what a wonderful story. I mean, the way the author used the word trick and plant. And so we've had – it's come to the point where it's been almost impossible in the end to pick a winner, which – of course, is a decision made by the judge. Last round, it was Ann Patchett, the novelist Ann Patchett. But each round is, you know, we face that challenge again. How do we pick the winner out of these amazing submissions? And I have to say, the other thing is, I was really surprised at how much enthusiasm there is around the country for this idea of microfiction. Because when we came up with it, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that I wasn't aware of how big a deal this was. I just thought, you know, let's do something that will bring the listeners in and that will hopefully allow our listeners to kind of create content for our show. And of course, they've answered in spades, right? So it turns out that this is an enormous phenomenon. I mean, there are clubs, sort of like book groups all over the country where people are writing this microfiction, and what's coming out of it, as you can see at our website, if you go to npr.org/3-minute-fiction, you can read all of the finalists, all of the winners from the previous four rounds, and you will find, I mean, gems. You will find pieces that are good enough to be in any of the best literary journals in America.
What does the winner win?
The winner wins a very typical NPR prize, which is $1 million. No,
the winner.
The winner wins. In every round, the winner has received a signed copy of the judge's book. And so last round it was Ann Patchett, and this round Michael Cunningham. And so they'll get a copy of his book, The Hours, and his new book, By Nightfall. And of course, their story gets read on the air in its entirety by that judge. So imagine you're, you know, a young or maybe not so young, struggling writer, unpublished writer, amateur who just, you know, somebody who just wants to try their hand at this. And by the way, two of our previous winners were all of them have been amateurs, but two of them haven't even been writers at all. One was a massage therapist. One was a waitress. Imagine your story that you wrote at your computer or at your desk is going to be read on national radio to 1.5 million people by a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer like Michael Cunningham. You know, we have literary agents who are hearing these programs, are interested in the winners and the finalists, and some of those people are being contacted. So it's a pretty incredible thing to be – and of course, you come on the program with our judge. So Michael Cunningham and the winner will be on with me, and we'll talk about the story and what he liked about it. And there you go. You sit back and you hear him read your story on national radio.
It sounds even better than a lapel pin.
I think so. I think so. I think it's pretty cool.
Guy, you are fairly new to Weekend All Things Considered. So tell me a little bit about your background at NPR before hosting the show.
So I came to NPR in 1997 as an intern. And a few months after I arrived here, I got my first job. My first job was as Daniel Shore's assistant. And so I literally learned at the feet of a master. I mean, you know, he was, I think, one of the greatest journalists who ever lived. Certainly somebody with more integrity I can't think of. I mean, he was such an incredibly gifted, brilliant, talented, honest, truth-seeking journalist. And he transmitted those lessons to the people who worked for him. And I had the privilege of being one of those people and, of course, attended his funeral this past summer when Dan sadly passed away. Over the years, I eventually became a reporter here. And then I was sent to Berlin as a Berlin bureau chief in 2000 and worked there, covered Eastern Europe and the Balkans. And then after 9/11... Afghanistan, and then I was transferred to London to be the bureau chief there, but I spent most of my time in Iraq and in the Middle East. And then I left NPR for 2 years. I went to CNN to try my hand at television. It was interesting. It wasn't for me. And in 2006, I came back to NPR after 2 years in television. I was the Jerusalem correspondent for CNN. And I came back to Washington. I covered the Pentagon for a few years. And I did a sabbatical. I went on a fellowship leave at Harvard has a program for journalists, mid-career journalists, where you can spend a year there and take classes and sort of work on a year-long project. And I spent a lot of time thinking about Weekend All Things Considered, which was a show that I wanted to host. And it was really during that year where I began to think about ideas for the program. And when I came back after my year away in June of 2009, I became the host of Weekend All Things Considered. And what we tried to do, you know, was really to change the show, not to sort of alienate people who are used to things about the show that they loved, but to sort of make it a different show, to make it a different experience than a weekly news program like Morning Edition or All Things Considered, which are amazing programs. But, you know, news doesn't always happen in the same way on the weekends as it does during the week. I think the weekends is often a chance to kind of step back and take a wider view of the news. And we've tried – that's what we've sort of been experimenting over the past year and a half.
Well, and Weekend Edition Saturday with Scott Simon, Weekend Edition Sunday with Leanne Hansen, who I know will be leaving the show within the next year. But those are both programs that have really found their voice with the hosts. And I've listened to Weekend All Things Considered for many years, and that's a show that I've always felt has a great deal of potential and has bounced around from host to host, and I don't know that it had found its voice. What appealed to you about taking over this show where people don't seem to last that long?
I mean, I think it was for all the reasons that you mentioned. You know, it was this idea that here I'm a product of NPR. I came to NPR out of college. This is the place I love and I'm committed to. But I was overseas for NPR, and I even left NPR for a couple of years. And that really gave me a window of why I love working in public radio and in public public media journalism, because it's – to me, it's so authentic. You know, I mean, you know this, Charity. We're not earning millions of dollars. We are committed to this profession because we're committed to finding out the truth and to you know, hopefully encouraging a civil discourse, you know, in Iowa or in New York or in Florida or all over the country. And so I thought, to me, that the whole idea of coming to this program was so appealing because it was a program that didn't, you know, that sort of went through so many different hosts over the past years and wasn't, you know, didn't really seem to have a separate identity. And I thought, here's a great opportunity to create that. Now, we have tried a lot of things on the show. We've brought a lot of rappers and hip-hop artists on the show. Now, a lot of our listeners say, what's going on? Why do you have Eminem on the show? But at the same time, you know, Eminem might not appear on another NPR program. And so what I try to do when I bring on different artists that might not appeal to everybody is to kind of have that artist explain what it is about their work that makes them important. You know, I mean, we had Eminem talking about his rhyme schemes, and he talked about how what he does when he rhymes is to really enunciate the language, and it's what it allows him to create these patterns of rhymes. And it was just so – I mean, it's the conversation he wouldn't have on MTV. It's a conversation he wouldn't have on commercial radio because, you know, he's talking about dropping his next record with Dr. Dre or whatever. And I kind of feel like our program is a lab. You know, we can try those things. We can talk about classical music in exactly the same way. You know, what is it about? We just did something on Mahler's Symphony of a Thousand. Well, how did Gustav Mahler mount this incredible, you know, composition with 1,000 people in Vienna? And then it's just a variety of things like 3-minute fiction. Now, not everything we do works. Sometimes it doesn't work. But we're prepared to experiment. And that's the whole exciting part of doing this job and being part of this program, that we can do that and that NPR has allowed us to do that and to try those things out.
So if you had to describe the voice that you're trying to achieve on Weekend All Things Considered, what would it be?
That's a really good question. I mean, it's certainly not young, and it's certainly not old, and it's not middle-aged. I think it's a program that The way I look at it is, in most of the country, we're on between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturday and then again on Sunday, a different program. And I think in Iowa, it's 4 to 5 on Saturday and mm-hmm. Sunday. Is that right?
Yes.
And my feeling is, you know, it's a nice day. The weather's great. We have to give you a reason to listen to the radio between 4 and 5 or 5 and 6 on Saturday and 5 and 6 on Sunday. We have to – it has to be – something there have to be elements of the show that are going to sparkle and that are going to leave you with questions and that are going to you're going to learn something and maybe your some of your assumptions are going to be challenged and maybe you're going to hear music that you just don't really like, but the artist is interesting and they're saying something that kind of speaks to you. I mean, that's what we want. I want this show to be a show that can be heard by three generations of people in the same room and for all of them to identify with it. You know, it's a challenge. It's not easy to do, but that's really our goal every week, is to try and reach, you know, those three generations sitting on the sofa listening to the program saying, hey, you know, I can understand where that person's coming from.
Now, you have been a foreign correspondent. You've been a bureau chief. You've traveled the world. Being a host of A Weekend All Things Considered, I would guess, involves a lot of sitting in the studio and staying home. Is that a challenge for you?
I mean, it is and it isn't. You know, we do travel. In January, we'll go to Haiti to revisit the one-year anniversary of the earthquake. And we do we try to bring the show to California and to do the program out of California as often as we can. I mean, it is in the sense that I was on the road all the time. I mean, I lived out of airports for 6 years. My life is different now. You know, I've got a kid. I'm married. And he's obviously my priority. He's a year and a half, and I try to spend as much time with him as I can. But, you know, we also have now that the sort of the first year plus of my hosting the program has kind of been established, this is the time where we're starting to plan for more travel, because it is important. I mean, you do have to go around the country and you do have to see what people are thinking about, what they're talking about, you know, what's going on in Iowa. I was hearing the promos in my headphones for the shows that you guys have that you're going to be having later on today. I mean, Sarah Palin's visit to Iowa. I mean, all these things are so interesting. Women not being elected to Congress in Iowa. I mean, these are things that you can't really become exposed to unless you go out and travel. So that's something that we will start to do more frequently, you know, starting now.
And back to the 3-minute fiction contest again, that this fifth round wraps up Sunday night at midnight. Do you try your hands at all of these different challenges?
I have. It's really hard. But the cool thing about it is it's hard that it sort of forces you to think clearly and concisely, but it's not too hard that it's daunting. I mean, it's 600 words, you know. Anybody can do it. It doesn't have to be a masterpiece. We're not all Tolstoy, you know, but we all have the ability to sit down and write 600 words. And it's doable. So, you know, one round was a photograph you had to look at online. This round, it's a sentence that has to start the story and another sentence that the story has to end with. It's a challenge, but it's also a realistic one, and it forces you to be economical with language, and it also forces you to think of a simple narrative or just a moment, you know, like a passing blip, something that just happens, that you just – like a frame or one frame of a shot of a film.
Guy Raz, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Guy Raz is the weekend host of NPR's All Things Considered. We've been talking today about the fifth edition of the 3-Minute Fiction Contest, and you can find out all the details about that at npr.org. Just search for 3-Minute Fiction. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio always available at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, a conversation with novelist Mary Helen Stefaniak. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.